Like to call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here with us today. The first order of business is going to be to take the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer, would you please take the roll?
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Eklund.
Eklund present.
Becker.
Becker present.
Bonner.
Bonner present.
Bierman.
Present.
Golden.
Present.
Dameth.
Dameth present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grinhagen.
Present.
Heal.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison present.
Munson.
Munson present.
Fryer.
Present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Niedernhofer. The next order of business is to approve the minutes of March 22nd. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Madam Chair, I will move.
Okay, Representative Dameth, thank you. Representative Dameth moves with help approval of the minutes of March 22nd. Is there any discussion to the minutes? All right, seeing none. All those in favor of approval of the minutes of March 22nd, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you. Okay, so members, today we are hearing House Bill 2128, which was filed by the chair, yours truly, because this is the governor's budget proposal. And the piece that we're hearing today are the pieces from the Department of Human Services that are in this committee's jurisdiction. So the way the two HHS committees are working this year, they don't line up by agency, they really line up by subject matter. And so a lot of the subject matter that is under the Department of Human Services is before our committee. So that's the piece that we're going to be talking about today. And there's a lot in this. So we're gonna get a walkthrough, and then we're gonna hear from members of the public on the various pieces. And this is, for those of you who haven't been through this process before, just again, to be really clear, this is the governor's budget. This is not necessarily what this committee's budget bill is going to look like, but you can probably be pretty safe in assuming that a lot of the pieces of what's in this bill will end up in our omnibus bill. So it's important to hear from the public on this and to try to understand the various pieces. And I'm going to be taking notes as we hear from the public, you know, things people like and things people don't like, so that we can take account of what we hear. But there is also an author's amendment. And what I'd like to do, if this works for members, I was thinking how to do this in the way that makes it most understandable and manageable for everyone. The author's amendment is the updates from the governor after the February forecast. So that's a big piece of it. And there are some further policy issues, but I thought it might be most useful to just adopt the amendment first and then have the department walk through it as amended. Let me just ask if any members have a preference for that, because what we originally had planned to do was have Mr. Burdick from DHS walk through the amendment itself and then adopt the amendment. But I think that would be a little bit out of context. So do members have a preference? Is it okay if we go ahead and adopt the author's amendment and then walk through the bill as amended? Because that, in fact, is the way we'll be considering it. So any comments on that from anyone? Please let me know if that does not work for you. Representative Pryor?
I was going to say, it does work for me. So I think it'll be easier to keep things straight and just focus on what the proposal is. So thank you, Madam Chair. I support that.
Thank you for that input, Representative Pryor. I appreciate that. And I hope that will work for our testifiers today. I know, Mr. Burdick, I know we didn't talk about doing it this way. Can you just tell me, will that work for you? Because I know it means that you have to do a little fancy changing up here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Matt Burdick with the Department of Human Services. If it's all right with you, I think process-wise that works just fine. If it's okay, if we can present the amendment sort of distinct from the rest of the bill, I know that's not exactly what you're hoping for. We just didn't have our testifiers prepared, and I don't want to put my colleagues on the spot unnecessarily, if that's all right. But we have people here that can engage in a rich discussion of the content of the amendment.
All right, so why don't we do this then? I will move the A210107 amendment to get the bill in the order in which I would like to have it presented. And then we can adopt that amendment. And then when we walk through the bill, Mr. Burdick, you can either just add at that point pieces that are different or new. And there may be things too that we are not actually getting to today that you can also talk about as we end the presentation, if that works. So I have moved the A210107 amendment to get the bill in the order in which I'd like to have it presented. All those in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
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 And any opposed? All right, the amendment is adopted. Thank you, members. So then the bill is before us, and this is a bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, I think we could turn then to Mr. Burdick. What's your pleasure? I know that Article 1 was going to be Ann Bops. Is she ready? And is that how you want to go ahead?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'll defer to my colleague Ann, who can start with our Healthcare Administration provisions.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Bops, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Ann Bops with the Department of Human Services. So I will begin walking through the base bill and then we'll bring some note the changes in the amendment as well. So in Article 1, that is the healthcare article, Section 1 relates to the proposal to modify the window for information gathering for inpatient rate setting. What this does is extends the time period for hospitals to appeal or correct the information DHS uses for both rates and the overall budget pool for inpatient hospital services from 12 to 18 months. Section 2 of the base bill relates to the proposal that is federal compliance align asset limits for Medicare savings programs. And this indexes the Medicare savings program asset limits to align with the Medicare Part D low income subsidy once the LIS asset limits exceed the Medicare savings program asset limits. Sections 3, 4, 9, and 10 relate to the governor's telemedicine expansion proposal. And this will, the provisions that we've included here will remove the current limit of 3 times per week for telemedicine services, clarify that the enrollee's home is an allowable originating site for covered telemedicine services, clarifying that for the early intensive developmental behavioral intervention, EIDBI program, coordinated care conference and individual intervention services may be provided via telemedicine, allows treatment provided via real-time two-way interactive video and audio and visual telemedicine visits to satisfy the face-to-face requirement for consideration of reimbursement under the payment methods that apply to FQHCs, rural health clinics, Indian Health Service, or 638 tribal clinics, and certified community behavioral health clinics if the service would have otherwise qualified for payment had it been performed in person. And then finally, it expands the list of providers whose services can be covered if performed via telemedicine. Sections 5 and 6 refer to the proposal that extends 90-day prescription refills and the dispensing fee change. This would allow certain non-controlled substance, low-cost medications to be filled in up to a 90-day supply. Modifies the pharmacy dispensing fee to align with the results of the 2020 cost of dispensing survey, and has a technical correction to the payment of multiple dispensing fees for pharmacy claims for a compound four drug. Section 7 relates to continuous access to public transportation through NEMT. That allows medical assistants to provide a monthly transit pass for any enrollee who is eligible for one public transit trip to a medically necessary covered service. Section 8 pertains to redesigning outreach activities for the child and teen checkup program. This would allow IHPs to take on responsibility for the child and teen checkup well child outreach for children who are already attributed to them. Section 11 refers to updating the rate methodology description in statute for outpatient hospital services. This just clarifies the rate methodology DHS uses to set payment rates for outpatient hospitals in state law. Sections 12 and 13 are technical clarifications related to expanding funding for the ICHRP program. And then sections 14, 15, and 16 apply to the proposal that is realigning Minnesota CARE statute with federal requirements. And so these repeal legislative changes in the Minnesota CARE statute that authorize staggered renewals using current income for financial eligibility and changing the timeline for annual updates to the federal poverty guidelines to July instead of January. So a few changes in the amendment. The first section of the amendment has to do with the COVID return back to better for hospital rebasing. Sections 1 and 2 of the amendment refer to those changes that are necessary. Then that's lines 1.2 through 7.13. Then line 7.14 removes duplicative statutes related to telemedicine for mental health services. Line 7.16 through 13.13 adjusts the FQHC and RH and rural health clinic rebasing to account for the impacts of COVID on utilization. Line 13.14 also removes duplicative statutes related to telemedicine for mental health services. Lines 13.15 through 13.32 of the amendment apply to MA eligibility and renewal procedures for the COVID Back to Better proposal. Lines 14.28 and 14.1 through 14.27 are the language for a study on the public option that was included in the supplemental budget. Lines 14.28 through 15.7 is language for the study on an outpatient payment rates that was included in the governor's supplemental budget. And with that, I will turn it over to Inspector Moti for Article 2 of the bill.
All right, thank you, Ms. Boff. So members, for those of you that are trying to keep track at home here, there's a lot here. And I just did want to flag for you that one of the documents that Mr. McQuillan sent out is a bill index that was in his, and I don't know if I just to tell you how I'm kind of tracking is I printed this out for myself, but you could pull it up on your computer as well. And that helps you as they're walking through here. It's a summary document and might make this all a little bit more understandable. And also just a flag for many of you, if some of these proposals are sounding a little bit familiar, they should, because we have talked about a number of them in committee. So at least the major proposals here, as you get through the bill language, it should be familiar to you that as something that we talked about more at length, at least I hope so. And Also, Mr. McQuillan is telling me that the DHS bill index is document number 4 in the documents that he sent out, if you're looking for that. Okay, well, thank you. Ms. Inspector Moti, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Kulani Moti, and I serve as the Inspector General here at DHS, and I'll be going over the bills related in our area. So this is Article 2, Licensing and Background Studies, in Sections 1, 2, 22, 23, and 24, adding new background study partners. And this adds background study requirement for navigators, in-person assisters, and certified application counselors to ensure statutes, updates the background study requirement in the Pelsby statutes, which is the Professional Educational Licensing Standards Board, and adds fees for background studies conducted for Minsure, Pelsby, and the Board of School Administrator. In Section 3, this is our withdrawal management fees. In 2015, licensing requirements for a Medicaid withdrawal management benefit were enacted. A licensing fee was not established at the time because the intent was for withdrawal management to replace the detoxification program license. However, since then, due to differences between the two types of programs, DHS allows providers to be licensed as withdrawal management, detoxification, or both, and this language adds a licensing fee for withdrawal management to Chapter 245A on that. In Sections 4 through 6, 9, 10 through 18, 20, and 21 through 33, this is our background studies federal compliance, and it modifies Chapter 245C to include background studies requirements in 245C rather than in various programmatic statutes, and would add all background studies requirements to 245C. It creates a new section, 245C.031, to codify alternative studies completed by DHS and forwarded to county and tribal agencies to make eligibility determinations. It also includes language that changes the basis of authority for DHS to receive national and state criminal history record information from Public Law 92.544 to the National Child Protection Act, Vulnerable Children's Act, also known as the NCPA-VCA. It clarifies that for child care facilities, an employee must be removed from the center, not just from direct care of children, if the employee is subsequently found to have committed a disqualifying offense. DHS would implement the updated Chapter 245C effective July 1, 2021. In Sections 7, 8, and 18, this is for the EIDVI background studies. It adds EIDVI providers to the list of providers subject to the background study requirement and in 245C, and would require them to use the NET study system. It creates clear exclusion criteria to apply to people who have criminal backgrounds that would otherwise prohibit them from working directly with children and vulnerable adults. This proposal will also identify as a single background study resource for EIDVI providers. And then Sections 25 and 34 is our transition to fee schedule for background studies. The proposal updates 245C to remove the fees from the statute and allow DHS to publish a fee schedule, which is similar to what the BCA does. Currently, fees for all study types are established in statute, and most of the studies are listed with a base fee of $20, which hasn't increased since 2005. More study types have been introduced, and more of those studies require higher level studies, including FBI and national maltreatment checks. And this, our current cost is well below the actual cost of DHS completing a study, and our average is around $42 per study. Changes would be effective July 1, 2021, with fee increases beginning September 1st, 2021. And then going forward, a fee schedule will be published in April or April 1st in subsequent years, with any increases effective July 1 of the same year. And then one moment, I have the, in regards to the amendment, Lines 15.8 through 23.32, and it's under our COVID Back to Better. And this is in regards to our background studies and background studies components to support the transition out of the COVID emergency period and other conforming changes to the other background studies provisions in the bill. And so that's all that I have. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think I'm turning this back over to Ann.
All right. Thank you, Inspector Multi. Okay. All right, Ms. Botts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So moving on to Article 3, which is the strategies related to the Blue Ribbon Commission that were included in the governor's budget. Sections 1, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9, and 16 are related to the proposal for the Uniform Administration of Non-Emergency Medical Transportation. And this would establish authority for a uniform NEMT program for MA and Minnesota Care enrollees, as well as eliminate some outdated language regarding the NEMT Advisory Council and administration of the benefit. Section 2 relates to the proposal for program integrity strategies and adds tribes within statute to explicitly include tribal agencies as direct recipients of FPI grant funding, subject to programmatic requirements applicable to county grant applicants. Sections 3, 6, 10, 11, 12, 15, and 16 relate to the proposal for uniform administration of the pharmacy and dental benefits. This would restructure the payments and administration of dental payments or of the dental benefits across MA and Minnesota Care by establishing a uniform administrator model and repurposing the critical access and rural dental rate add-ons into a 54% rate increase over the current MAC schedule for adult dental services and a 24.4% rate increase for children's dental services. It also moves administration of the medical assistance outpatient drug benefit to DHS. And then sections 13 and 14 relate to the proposal for the durable medical equipment DME rate methodology. This changes the medical assistance rate reimbursement formula for DME that is also covered by Medicare but not currently subject to the upper payment limit to pay the equivalent Medicare rate, and then simplifies the reimbursement formula for products that don't have a Medicare rate to a methodology based on the provider's cost. And then to the amendment, lines 23.33 through 24.14 relate to the Blue Ribbon proposal for the encounter alerting system. This was language that was erroneously omitted from the original draft of the language related to the proposal that expands use of the healthcare provider encounter alerting system. Lines 24.16 and 25.2 through 25.24 are related to the pharmacy carve-out, and this modifies the co-payment for brand name drugs included on the state's preferred drug list, PDL, to be equivalent to generic drug co-payments. Lines 25.25 through 25.27 adjusts the effective date of the pharmacy carve-out to align with the completion of necessary IT work at DHS. Lines 25.28 through 25.30 is related to a modification that was made in the DME proposal. Then this restores the state-only funded higher rate for pressure support ventilators. And that, Madam Chair, concludes my walkthrough of the Blue Ribbon Commission section.
All right, thank you. So other than that, the DHS portion of the bill is Article 6, which I think is the appropriations section, and we weren't going to walk through that. I think we have Mr. Greenman here if there are questions about the appropriations. And so I just do want to make a comment, knowing that, you know, some of you are kind of newer to this process, and this can be a very confusing process. Not only there's a ton of information that we're dealing with here, but the format in which we look at this is really different than what you might expect. And so just one thing that took me a number of years to understand until I actually was chairing a committee and writing and in charge of putting together a bill is that as we walk through, and you might notice the testifiers are saying, they're talking about sections that aren't necessarily next to each other, that proposals are kind of spread out in different sections of the bill. And that's because the bill is written in the order of the statutes that it affects. So that it took me a while to kind of figure that out. And I don't know, I'm sure that Mr. Chun is on this call. And if I'm wrong about that, Mr. Chun, please tell me right now, because otherwise I've given members misinformation. But that's why the bills are written in the order of the statutes. And so that's why sometimes different certain proposals kind of are spread out all over the place, so it seems. So you can't read it the way you would read a novel. Like things don't necessarily fall into what would seem to be regular order. Okay, anyway, I don't see anybody from House Research telling me that I messed that up. So we can probably assume that it's close to true. Okay, so now we're going to hear testimony on the various provisions of the governor's budget, and we're going to do it article by article. So, also this is our attempt to try to help to make this a little bit more understandable for members, to ask testifiers to do this article by article. And Ms. Krinke is first. And so if you can, testifiers, those that are on right now, if you can be very clear with us about what proposal you're discussing, just so that this will be, your testimony will be much more helpful to us if we all understand what proposal you are addressing. And I know Ms. Krinke is a master at this, so I'm sure she'll do a great job and set the tone for all other testifiers in that respect. So welcome, Ms. Krinke.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And as the I have the distinction of getting to go first because I'm talking about Article 1, Section 4, which is the telehealth section of the bill. And just quickly, we think that this is terrific language that is in the bill regarding telehealth provisions for our public program enrollees. It does, however, omit one key provision that we think is very important, and that is during the public health emergency, we have been able to use the old-fashioned telephone as a modality for telehealth. This has been extremely important to our senior citizens, to the areas of the state that still do not have broadband, and quite frankly, it has helped with disparities. There are many people who simply cannot afford to have a laptop or a computer. It has also, and we've heard this from our mental health practitioners, it has been terrific, the provision of mental health services, as people have not always wanted to have a camera on them or for folks to see their home. This is all included in a bill of Representative Morrison's House File 1412, and we are hopeful that that will be included in the chair's omnibus bill. Last and closing comment on telehealth, all of these waivers expire June 30th. So we need either this bill, the omnibus bill, to pass with those provisions, or a standalone bill to pass with those provisions. We would like to have the waivers, as Ms. Brops Ann mentioned in her testimony, all the other waivers we are supportive of. The governor's bill language omits the telephone. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Ms. Krinke. Next we have Sarah Durr. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Sarah Durr. I'm the executive director at the Minnesota Pharmacists Association, and I know you guys have heard from me previously in this committee. Today, I'm testifying on behalf of all Minnesota Pharmacy and the Minnesota Pharmacy Alliance. The Alliance represents all the pharmacy in Minnesota, including health system pharmacies, regional chain pharmacies, grocery store pharmacies, and independently owned pharmacies across the state. Thank you for taking the time to examine proposals with the governor's budget that will positively impact patients, expand access, and reduce the cost of healthcare for Minnesotans. For example, Minnesota Pharmacy supports your proposal to move to a fee-for-service pharmacy drug benefit model for medical assistance members. We also think that the overall budget that the department is proposing and much of the legislation that the chair is considering to include in the Health Finance Policy Committee's omnibus bill is very important. However, today I come before the committee to voice Minnesota Pharmacy's opposition to the provision that would negatively impact Minnesota Pharmacy noted in Section 6 of the bill. payment rates for covered services, the reduction to Minnesota pharmacy reimbursement for medical assistance. We oppose the reduction to the department's recommended pharmacy reimbursement rate of $9.91. First, their recommendation takes the median weighted average of all prescription medications dispensed by Minnesota pharmacies. The department's cost of dispensing survey reported this past January states that the median weighted average of medical assistance prescription medications dispensed by Minnesota pharmacies is $10.77. The 86 cent reduction that is currently proposed would negatively impact pharmacy. There are two components of reimbursement for pharmacies when dispensing a medication. The first is the cost of the medication. Since the state adopted the CMS outpatient drug rule in 2019, Minnesota pharmacies have used the National Average Drug Acquisition Cost, or NADAC, index for medical assistance reimbursements of ingredient products in Minnesota. NADAC is a continually updated and is a true index of the actual ingredient costs that pharmacies pay for the medication. The second is the cost of the pharmacy for dispensing the medication. This includes any costs associated with dispensing a medication and includes overhead, rent or mortgage for the space that they are in, and patient counseling, et cetera. The department's cost of dispensing survey recently completed by Mercer concludes that median weighted average for dispensing a prescription medication for MA patients is $10.77, as I mentioned. This means that 50% of the pharmacy's dispensing costs is actually more expensive than $10.77, and 50% of the pharmacy's dispensing costs is less than $10.77. Adopting the department's recommended reduction in reimbursement to pharmacies when their own study shows that the current state or current rate of 1048 is below the median cost is something we oppose. Implementing the recommendation rate would mean that pharmacies are going to take a financial hit. Minnesota pharmacies are critical healthcare access points for medical assistance patients. At a time when Minnesota has had the most pharmacy closures in the country in the last decade, now is not the time to reduce the rate of reimbursement. In fact, we need your help to ensure a modest and reasonable increase to 1077 is adopted as part of the final budget. Again, thank you for allowing pharmacy to testify today. I'd be happy to take any questions.
All right, thank you very much, Dr. Durr. Appreciate it. And also we do, members, we have had some submitted testimony as well, and I certainly encourage everyone to read that. And I don't know if Dr. Durr submitted something, but I hope so, because some of this we probably should have in writing. Okay, next on my list is Coral Riplinger. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Coral Riplinger, and I'm a public health supervisor at Dakota County. I'm also here on behalf of the local public health association, and I'm here to speak to the proposal in the budget bill regarding the Minnesota's early and periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment services program, or EPSDT. Its primary focus is on prevention, early intervention, and health equity for low-income children. Child and Teen Checkups, or CNTC, is Minnesota's version of the EPSDT program. Local public health and tribal nations are contracted by DHS to provide administrative services for the CNTC program. Services include providing outreach in the community about the importance of well child visits, assisting families with scheduling medical and dental appointments, and arranging transportation interpreter services. Local public health and tribal nations are also contracted to coordinate and collaborate with WIC programs, Head Start, schools, managed care, immunization services, home visiting services, and social services programs such as children's mental health, housing, and foster care. Local public health and tribal nations are also contracted to provide outreach, education, and training to our local clinics and health systems, which include IHPs, to ensure they understand the components of the screening standards and to provide local information and resources for the families seen in these clinics. Local public health is concerned about the proposal in this bill that takes 50% of outreach and funding from counties and tribes and moves them to the IHPs. The families we work with know us, use our services, and trust us. For example, in Dakota County, we utilize community health workers and public health nurses in our community to ensure that families not only receive information about the benefits of CNTC, but also address social determinants of health, which include housing, food access, and energy assistance. We also ensure that families are getting connected with dental clinics and when they move between health clinics and systems. The proposal mentions that participation rates trend below national averages. However, in 2017, Minnesota made significant changes in the screening schedule in which more screenings and intervals were added. Prior to this, Minnesota's participation rate was 73% and was in alignment with the national average. Over the past 2 years, public health has been working with clinic systems to capture these changes in their electronic health records and to ensure proper billing and documentation, and have been working with families to change behavior around these screening schedules, all in which takes time. One challenge that we've experienced with this work is a dated technology system. The system is called CATCH, and it has hindered our outreach and reporting and limits us significantly to the types of data we receive. Prior to the start of the pandemic, local public health was diligently working with DHS on solutions to improve technology in hopes to better use tools such as emailing or texting to increase our outreach rather than utilizing decades-old mailing systems to reach clients. We hope to continue these conversations with DHS. We look forward to continuing to provide this important service to our communities in the future. Thank you for your time today, and I'm happy to field any questions the committee may have.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Ripplinger. And are there questions for members? I think the best way to do this might be just to go take a few moments to see if there are questions at the end of each article with this group of testifiers, because I think they may not stay till the end. So are there questions for these testifiers? Representative Pryor.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. All right, so I got the answer to my question from when it was presented before, which is when we were talking about well child and teen checkups and the outreach that's done by the county and the tribal nations, what else is happening in addition to making sure they're getting scheduled for exams? And I think this is something that does make sense to me when I heard the discussion by Ms. Ripplinger, that they are getting connected to other social determinants of health. And I know from the Early Childhood Committee, we've talked about early Head Start and how they get connected, how a family could get connected to early Head Start. So, but now I guess I need to just understand maybe more precisely what would be changing under the system. Is it just the governor's proposal moves some money out of the counties and tribal nations that they're using to do outreach? Or are we also losing the capacity to connect with those families? Which is kind of like, this is the data trail. How a family is kind of, the record keeping of whether or not a family has been connected to or not. And is it just money for outreach that we're talking about, or is it more behind the governor's proposal? And I'm not sure who I'm addressing that question to.
Well, Representative Pryor, I know I'm kind of wondering that myself. Maybe we could ask Ms. Ripplinger to just briefly address that from her point of view. I mean, we really should get DHS to respond to. And, you know, we had Assistant Commissioner Matt Anderson here to talk about the proposal, and I don't believe he's here today. So let's get the testifier's response, and then, you know, we can certainly circle back with DHS as well at a different point. Ms. Ripplinger, were you able to get the question? And
yes, right. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Pryor and Chair Liebling for the question. I don't really know what DHS plans to cut from our budget besides that the children that are currently enrolled in the IHPs would be have their outreach done with the IHPs instead of with public health. I can say that our budget that we have to do this work is for staffing. Majority of the budget is for staffing so we can get out in the communities to reach these families and to reach those who may not have a clinic, may not have a system to go to. And I do think that this would negatively impact the work that we could do if our funding is is drastically cut.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And my understanding of the proposal itself, as I recall, Representative Pryor, was there was they're paying $26 per child to the counties for this outreach, and the savings comes from with the IHPs do it directly, and it was just supposed to be for the checkups that it would be less to have the IHPs do it. That's my recollection of the proposal itself, and we can talk more about that. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm on the same question, and hopefully a couple more comments from Ms. Ripplinger about the system you're using now. And I guess I just wondering if you have an approximate of how many children are already covered in the IHPs versus how you're accessing or reaching those kids that are not involved in an IHP. And what are your other contact points? You mentioned direct by emails, and I think cell phone versus this program, which would be, how would this program be different and affect your work? And let's start with that, please.
Okay, Ms. Ripplinger.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. I'll do my best to remember all the questions with this, but for Dakota County, I can speak to Dakota County's numbers, and it would be about a $274,000 budget cut for our program in Dakota County. We see about 41,000 children in child and teen checkups in Dakota County, so it's a very significant reduction for us. And I also, this is just with the numbers today that are in currently enrolled in IHPs. For what I know, DHS probably has a little bit more information, but if their goal is to get 50% in IHPs versus local public health or tribal nations, it would be 50% of our budget would be gone and 50% of our staffing.
And Representative Bierman, and you know, members, I think we're going to have to probably speed things up just a bit here to get through everything we have to, but sure. Representative Bierman, brief follow-up.
Just the follow-up, only follow-up I'll do right now is, so Ms. Ripplinger, can you tell me if schools, reaching students through the schools is part of your process of reaching these kids?
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Bierman and Chair Liebling. Yes, we do work with our schools. We actually have partnerships with our school nurses and our superintendents, and have a close relationship working with our partners in schools to better reach our children. As we know, by reaching our partners, we can have a greater impact on the outreach done beyond just the one-on-one individual outreach. So we are working with our schools in several different ways. We work also with our ECFE classes, early childhood education. We provide education and on prevention and talk about child and teen checkups and all the different components and why it's important that these screenings are done.
Thank you, Ms. Ripplinger. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Bonner, is your question to the same issue?
It is not.
Okay, so let me give DHS a chance then, because I think they want to respond on this issue, and then we'll go to your question. So I think that Mr. Hayes is here to talk about this. Or someone from DHS that could discuss this issue.
Oh, apologies, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I double mute situation. Sorry. I'll try to answer some of the questions that came up, but apologies if I don't recall all the questions that came up over the last few minutes. One, to just be very clear, the child and teen checkups outreach.
I'm sorry, you do need to do the little introduction.
Apologies, Madam Chair. Diogo Hayes, Department of Human Services, Race and Policy Manager. Thank you, Madam Chair. So one, just to be very clear, the outreach that we're talking about related to child and teen checkups is specific outreach prescribed in federal law. And it's very, very specific to only doing outreach related to well child visits. And that's what the payment to the counties is going to. And that's what we're shifting to the integrated health partnerships. Additionally, I wanted to mention that part of this role is also following up after visits happen. And so the thought is putting that responsibility with the providers that are responsible for the well-child visit to also follow up on referrals that are identified during the well-child visit will hopefully increase the number of children that go back for referrals. And the data suggests that that assumption is true. I also wanted to mention, Mr. Blieger mentioned that this proposal doesn't move all children to IHPs. It only moves for children who are already enrolled in an IHP. They would take on the responsibility. For kids that are not part of an IHP, they would remain receiving their outreach through a county or the tribe in which they reside. I'm happy to answer more questions if there are some.
All right, thank you. And Representative Bonner.
Thank you, I'll try to be quick. The first is I want to appreciate and thank Ms. Krenke for pointing out that there was a bit of a gap in that telehealth, and I know Representative Morrison's bill does actually cover that, which we heard earlier in committee. But the other piece that I have and the question that I have is around the reimbursement rates. I have to be honest, I'm a little bit concerned about moving down those reimbursement rates. We know that disproportionately impacts some of our smaller pharmacies who may have some more challenges trying to cover out and smooth out the edges. And I'm just curious if we have someone here that could give us a little bit better understanding of the rationale behind changing that reimbursement rate.
Okay, so you probably are looking for someone from DHS who can answer that. Mr. Hayes, can you do that one as well?
I think so, Madam Chair. Apologies. To clarify the question, why we want to reduce the reimbursement rate for telephone? Getting them out.
No,
yes.
No.
Okay,
we're talking about the pharmacy rate, I believe, right?
Correct.
Did I get it wrong?
The reimbursement rate for pharmacists.
Apologies. Yeah. We have another testifier here that can help you out with that.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. This is Chad Hope with DHS, Deputy Director for Purchasing and Service Delivery. The rate that was put forward in the governor's budget proposal comes out of the 2020 cost of dispensing survey. The cost of dispensing survey was funded out of the 2019 legislative session when the dispensing fee was raised to $10.48 based on an Indiana survey. The way these surveys work is they don't come back with a single number and say, this is the right number for a revised dispensing fee. It provides a whole menu, whole table of different variables based on the survey respondents. I believe we had somewhere in the neighborhood of 74% of surveys sent in a response that could be used in the final evaluation. Some aren't included because, say, the pharmacy hasn't been opened a year, or they're not actually physically located in Minnesota. So the report details out all of those steps. And then once you get the results, it's really a matter of looking at the data and evaluating where the rate is and what you want to accomplish with the policy goal. So looking at some of our other reimbursement structures where the costs are based or the rates are based on a 50th percentile of cost for other services, that's why we went forward in the proposal of trying to align the pharmacy dispensing fee, where half of all claims would be reimbursed at a rate higher than what they actually cost, and half of all claims would be reimbursed at a rate less than what they cost, trying to get right in the middle. Now, that's not to say that any one number in the survey is more valid than another. It's just simply that is the number that was put forward for that based on the survey respondents.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Hope. And so I'm going to go to Representative Pryor, then we're going to move on, members, because we have a whole list of testifiers who are waiting and to talk about other articles. And what I would ask members to do is, you know, please, today is not to debate the policies or to state our opinions. It's just if we need clarifying information from people who are before us to testify. And there will be other opportunities to debate the policy. So Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I did want to hear more information about the telephone part of telehealth and why that is being handled differently. So, and I think it sounded like perhaps we DHS would be able to make a comment on that.
Yes. Okay. I'm not sure who. And just to remind members, we did also hear a presentation on DHS's work that they did to try to evaluate telehealth during the pandemic. So we did have that information from Ms. Marquardt, I believe. But Mr. Hayes, is that yours as well?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Pryor. Again, Geogos Department of Human Services. Generally, we would just like to, we'd like additional time to look into it. The concern might be that a telemedicine visit delivered via phone is just not going to be the same as an experience as in person or possibly with video. And so we would just like to take some additional time to understand from the members that used phone during the time, members of the Medicaid program, to see if it was as effective as other modalities of telemedicine. And then the second part is then think about whether or not there should be a rate differential with that. Is the telephone the same cost of operation as using a two-way interactive video or an in-person visit?
All right, thank you. Okay, let's move on then. Thank you very much to these testifiers. And so now we're going to move on to the background, the Article 2 of the bill. And we have just one testifier signed up for that, and it's Idil Abdul. Welcome, Ms. Abdul.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Idil Abdul. I am testifying about Article 2 for the...
And Ms. Abdul, I'm sorry to interrupt. We're having a lot of trouble hearing you. If you can speak up or move closer to your mic.
Okay, I apologize. I'm so not tech savvy yet. So again, Madam Chair, my name is Idil Abdul. Many thanks for the opportunity to testify today regarding the governor's budget for DHS. I am a Somali autism mom and advocate. And first, I would like to thank the chair and other members who were here when we passed a bill that covered autism therapy for Medicaid autistic children and their families. Because of your hard work and efforts, many kids with autism are now able to get the medically necessary treatments they need. Unfortunately, at that time, we were so eager to pass this unprecedented legislation in Minnesota that we did not include the background study portion. As you know, autism is a developmental disability that affects the person's ability to communicate, sensory processing needs, and behavior regulation. Often, individuals with autism can recall word for word a movie they saw a year ago, but might not be able to remember what happened to them that morning. Therefore, it is extremely important to have background checks for everyone who has access to these vulnerable children. I know that DHS have put this in every year, and this is the first time I am trying to advocate, at least testify publicly. I see that the DHS has a provision this year in the governor's budget in Article 2, Section 8, Subdivision 15, lines 37.24 to 37.29. I fully support this section that all providers enrolled in EIDVI agency are required to have their background study done before they have access to the children. I hope Minnesota is proactive in this rather than reactive, which is what happened, as you all remember, in the Jensen case. We must protect children with autism proactively. Again, I thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Abdul. Absolutely. Really appreciate, and I know you gave us your written testimony as well, so thank you for that. Okay, we're going to move on to Article 3 then, and this covers a number of things since these are the items that were in the BRC report. So first on the list is Phil Stahlberger. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Phil Stahlberger, Vice President of Public Affairs for MTM. By the way, it stands for Medical Transportation, not Mary Tyler Moore, just to be clear. MTM has been in business for 25 years. We're in 32 states doing exactly what the Blue Ribbon Commission suggests, which is non-emergency transportation, utilizing everything from ambulances to public transportation to public transportation, as I said, and other forms of transportation. We support the effort that the governor has in the budget and the Blue Ribbon Commission. NEMT is a hard, difficult business. We understand that. There's a lot of people that will talk about what happened 20 years ago. Minnesota has continually tries to improve how we do NEMT in Minnesota. Every state has similar issues. Recent audits in the past have shown that Minnesota could probably use a little more consistency, some better coordination, more protocols to ensure safety and program integrity. The reports in the Blue Ribbon Commission is a first step in that. While we already require and comply with a lot of those things in the audit, we know that essentially Minnesota probably could use one set of rules for all NEMT across the entire country, all the counties, sorry. We do work with 17 counties, Hennepin, Ramsey, Dakota, all the way up to Stearns, Pine, St. Louis, et cetera. We provide about 55,000 trips. And with that, we know that 40% of those trips are autism related. The other 40% are specialty cases such as cancer, dialysis, drug treatment, rehabilitation, et cetera. So we have the data. We do require a lot of compliance. We understand it's a very highly regulated business. And we hope that the Blue Ribbon Commission did its work in looking at how to best focus NEMT in Minnesota. We think this is a good way to do that. Happy to answer any questions. Again, I know that time is short. I'll keep my comments to a minimum and look forward to any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Brent Custard, welcome.
Welcome, Madam Chair. Thank you. I am the director for Metro Transportation for North Memorial Health Ambulance. Our company has been in service since 1961, and we provide medical transportation services, both emergent and EMT services throughout the state of Minnesota and parts of Wisconsin. I'm speaking more towards having to experience this in the past as both as a STS driver when I started my career supervising these programs, managing and now directing, that there are already barriers and large time constraints into setting up these transports and getting clients and patients in and out of facilities in a timely manner. Also, reimbursement becomes a part of this as well. Obviously, we are businesses, and the reimbursement for these are very low compared to operating costs for that. But what I want to speak to mostly is COVID has shown us anything that's just as important to get patients into the hospital and up and out. Mainly, the processes that we have in place historically when we've done this back in the early 2000s, 2006, 2007, when we kind of had the same concept in place, it did create barriers to moving clients and patients in a very timely manner. And if COVID has caused anything, we need to free up these beds as rapidly as possible. There were also barriers to that program, as I'm stated, especially on nights, weekends, and holidays, and in my belief, caused undue stress on the patients in terms of billing and other factors of having to now struggle with trying to get the prior offs and things like those occurred. Along with this, obviously, NEMT services are vitally important to the state. We agree with that. We do have a full compliance program and list program here and work very closely with the DOT and other services to make sure we are billing properly and taking the proper patients by these, and I believe that that part of it should be placed more on the services, and some of these things, instead of setting up a brokerage, could be done by audits in that fact. For that, also, since COVID, we have seen our requests increase since other transportation companies have set down shut down during that time, and we have seen our increase, and we're struggling to also keep up with requests. On average, we do 30 to 40 transports a day in this realm, and our average cost of the transport is $190, and we're getting reimbursed on average $88. So for us, that leaves us of a last year in 2020, a loss of over $800,000 to provide these services. Again, we do think it is vitally important that these services are provided, but we don't believe that the proposals of this is the best way to go about that.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Rosie Anderson, and just to all the testifiers, we're happy to have you. Just be sure you give us your name and who you're representing. And do please try to stick to 2 minutes because we want to give everybody an opportunity. Okay, Ms. Anderson, welcome.
Thank you. I'm the Revenue Cycle Billing Director for North Memorial Ambulance. In addition to providing ambulance services, we also provide non-emergency transportation. I'm testifying regarding the billing and reimbursement concerns of switching to a brokering model for non-emergency transportation. We understand the reason for this bill is to address concerns regarding fraud. I've been with North Memorial for over 20 years, and I've never been contacted by the Department of Human Services regarding fraudulent billing. As transportation providers, we ask, where is the fraud? Representatives from DHS tell us there is extensive fraud in the industry, and if they know where that fraud is, then they must know the organizations that are committing the fraud, and why aren't they addressing these organizations? Most of our transports are for discharges from hospitals. We serve 5 hospitals within the greater metropolitan area. The patients have been treated at the facility, and the mode of transportation has already been determined by the physician attending the patient, and that documentation is in the patient's chart. Requiring an outside review by a third party who has no knowledge of the patient condition or the needs at the time of transport delays the transport and creates additional burden to discharge planner. The problem with using a broker is a discharge planner at the hospital either don't have time to contact the broker or they forget to do it. If this happens, we cannot bill for our transportation services. Not being able to bill for the transport because it wasn't authorized and the low reimbursement we receive when it is authorized creates a financial loss to our organization. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you so much for your testimony. Jeff Newstad, welcome.
Welcome. Chair Liebling and members, my name is Jeff Newstad, and I'm here today representing Lakes Medivan Incorporated. I would like to oppose the governor's proposal of the HF number 2128. In regards to the drastic changes to the NEMT program. We have been in the NEMT business for over 36 years, and we serve about 37 rural counties in the state. We transport around 2,000 recipients of medical assistance a month. And the last year has been very trying since COVID. Lack of business, low rates, added cost to the due to the COVID have made it near impossible to exist. We asked for help from DHS and received nothing. Some health plans have increased our reimbursement rate, and without that increase, we would not be in business today. The broker model has failed 3 times in this state. DHS continues to push for that system. In the years that DHS claims there has been fraud, are the same years and are in the same counties that the broker model was in place. So it is obvious it does not work. The impact to our clients and to the providers, if you reduce the program by millions of dollars, will be devastating to the infrastructure. This will force myself and other providers to go out of business. If the NEMT program does not exist, clients will not get to their much needed medical appointments. This industry was started because it was a cost savings to the taxpayers and it gave patients access to life-saving medical treatments. In fact, we need at least a 20% rate increase to stay in business. With the cost of fuel and insurance and other associated costs that have risen in the last year, we have been a loyal provider to this program, but without an increase, we will be closing our doors. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony. Scott Isaacson, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Scott Isaacson. I'm here today representing Lyft Transportation, which has been serving rural communities of East Central and Northern Minnesota for 22 years. Our organization strongly opposes HF 2128 regarding the radical restructuring of Minnesota's non-emergency medical transportation program. First, reducing rates for NEMT providers will actually result in increased healthcare costs in the future. There's a study by Florida State University that showed that every dollar spent on NEMT actually saves $11 in healthcare costs down the road. Managed care, along with adequately funded providers, have demonstrated tremendous effectiveness at providing high quality NEMT service while controlling costs, as both parties have a vested interest in the safety, service quality, and overall health of managed care members. As costs continue to rise, it will be impossible for us to provide necessary levels of service and care if rates aren't increased respectively. There needs to be a push to invest more in NEMT, helping remove barriers to care for those who need it most. Secondly, the broker model for NEMT has already proven itself incapable of meeting the needs of Minnesotans with physical, mental, and financial challenges. 2014, MTM failed as a broker for Blue Cross, resulting in termination of their week-old contract. Recently, Blue Cross contracted with LogistiCare to manage transportation for their members. After only a few months, Blue Cross terminated this contract as well because LogistiCare failed to provide adequate service. Those are the two largest brokers in the country, and they proved they're unable to meet the needs of even a small segment of the population affected by this proposed legislation. If this failed model is expanded, those who desperately need the care, people with disabilities, vulnerable adults, elderly, and children will be left behind. As a result, this group's healthcare will decline, costs will escalate, and they're going to require more intensive, urgent emergency care. HF2128 will expand a failed broker model and add a layer of unnecessary costs. Brokers only have a transactional interest in the care of the people they serve. This funding would be better allocated in the form of rate increases for transportation providers. Then we can provide improved levels of service, hire more trained professional drivers, and serve the expanding needs of Minnesotans. Just yesterday, our organization had to turn away the equivalent of 30% of our schedule because we're currently unable to hire a sufficient number of qualified drivers under the current rate structure. On behalf of our organization and the people we serve, please don't allow HF2128 to move forward. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you. Okay, let's see. I think the next person is Rudy Finsep. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Rudy Finsep. Welcome. Rudy Finsep. Okay. Let's see. Let's go to Buck McAlpin.
Madam Chair and members, thanks. Buck McAlpin. I represent the Minnesota Ambulance Association and the Rural Non-Emergency Alliance called R80. I've talked times as we had informational hearings about this issue, and we've appreciated that. I think some providers today have covered some of the issues with the program, but I actually wanted to just talk about the fiscal note because I spent some time looking at that today, which I know this committee has to consider. Overall, by eliminating managed care, that's managing about 75 or 80% of this program now and moving it all to a single broker or a multiple broker program across the state, it looks like on the fiscal note, the program spends about $107 million every 2 year biennium. When we look out into the tails of the program, where the program goes into full swing, the program captures a $65 million savings in the Blue Ribbon Commission's task force recommendation. So if my math is right, Madam Chair, that leaves a $40 million line item as a spend for a broker to pay capitated rates and coordinate 1.2 to 1.4 million Medicaid enrollees statewide for the program. So as I think you've just heard the last few testifiers state, their issue is they need rate increases into the program. And if my math is right, this proposal eliminates 60% of the Medicaid funding. Mr. Stahlberger testified earlier, if they have a way that they could offer this program statewide for $40 million, I think we'd all be very interested in hearing how that works. So again, I think as Brent testified from the ambulance side, a large concern, as we've heard earlier in the EMS industry, about our reduction of rural non-emergency. It continues to deteriorate, and we need to beef it up as best as we can. So thanks for the opportunity, Madam Chair, to testify on the issue again.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. I'm going to go back to Randy Finseth. Mr. Finseth, are you here? Hello? We can sort of hear you. Oh, looks like you're having technical problems getting unmuted.
I wonder, Madam Chair, this is Representative Keel. Mr. Finseth is part of my district. I wonder if he sees that he needs to unmute.
Well, he was unmuted for a second there,
okay.
Representative Keel. So,
thanks.
Mr. Finseth, do you want to? You do appear to be muted right now. If you can unmute yourself. Okay. You know what? We'll go on to the next testifier, Mr. Finseth, and happy to take you if you're able to make the connection. The next one on the list is Jan Roars. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members. My name is Jan Roars. I own People's Express, an EMT company that's been serving 23 rural Minnesota counties for over 20 years. Thank you for this opportunity to speak today to oppose the governor's proposal in House File 2128. You've been hearing testimony today about the negative consequences of implementing a broker in the MNET program, and I am totally in agreement with this view. Primarily, the bottom line is simple and straightforward. As with previous attempts at brokering transportation, it is clear that a broker was unable to handle the complexities and volumes of rural non-emergency medical transportation then, and will have the same result again. It does not take any imagination to know the results will be a disruption and drastically reduced or unavailable transportation to the vulnerable people who need it. COVID has had drastic consequences to the MNET industry. My company saw an approximate 63% drop in volume just in the past year. While some transportation is slowly returning, the landscape of the industry is forever changed. DHS did nothing to recognize this struggle to continue operations or provide support. Fortunately, the MCOs recognized the importance of helping maintain the transportation network and provided a lifeline for us. These MCOs represent approximately 75% of the transportation, with the fee-for-service having the remaining 25%. The idea of moving 75% of enrollees to a program that admits cannot supervise it, rather than moving the lesser 25% to systems that are able to do a good job, doesn't make sense to me. Reference has been made to economies of scale by using a broker. A flat amount is paid to a broker no matter how many or how few services are provided. The obviously incentive is to provide less rather than more services. As was the case previously under a broker, many rides were missed or not scheduled. There are serious consequences to individuals that do not receive their care in a timely manner. It was further suggested that the claimed savings could be reinvested in rate increases if the legislature chose to do that. The legislature would have no input on rates once the broker has control over the rates. I am not naive enough to think that with the safety net of rates in statute removed, a voluntary increase would happen. I would appreciate your support for the future of the MNET industry by not enacting the governor's proposal to the MNET program in House File 2128. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. David Jordahl.
Good afternoon. This is Dave Jordahl from Allina Health, and I am the manager of our FTS operation. And I am here to testify against House File 2128. The broker has been tried three times in the past that I can remember, and I don't remember it ever working. We do hospital discharges here. We have 10 hospitals in the system. It's a patient flow throughput issue for us, and that's all we do. We do about 35 to 40 calls a day, and over half of those are Medicaid-related trips. Allina has been subsidizing this service for many years, and Brent offered some numbers earlier, and I believe our numbers are actually higher than that. We make about $40 on an average trip, and it costs us $150 to do it. These are bed-to-bed trips. These are not door-to-door or station-to-station. This is bed-to-bed, and the money is just not right. I would prefer to see the state increase the rates and hold the providers to a higher standard, not punish them for defrauding the government. How about if they pay them more, and people value that contract, and they would never think about defrauding a contract that they were making money at. The middle person in the past, so the way it works is a person gets ready for discharge, social worker does all the planning, calls their dispatch center, it's all same day stuff. And to call a broker puts a delay on the whole process. And time is important to get those beds turned over so the people in the operating rooms and the emergency department can occupy those beds. We have had just a recent issue where a social worker called the broker on a Friday night for a discharge and never got the call back. That patient ended up staying in the hospital the whole weekend because we did not get an authorization for a trip. And which I quickly comment to them, don't let that happen. You just call our dispatch center. We will do it without getting reimbursed because it's that important to get those beds turned over. So I would strongly support doing away with the broker in House File 2128. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Jordahl. So we're going to pause here because we're going to switch subjects with our testifiers, and we have four testifiers. Representative Hewitt, do you have a quick question? And then before we change subjects?
Madam Chair, in the interest of the committee moving forward, I'll hold back and I'll meet with MTM separate. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Okay. Mayor Krinke.
Thank you, Madam. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I'm referring now to Article 3.10 of the bill. MHA is opposed to carving out the outpatient prescription drug benefit from the prepaid medical assistance program and moving this benefit to the fee-for-service program. This will result in a significant loss in payments to all critical access hospitals and to our safety net hospitals that care for a large number of low-income individuals. These hospitals are currently able to receive higher reimbursements from the health plans because they are qualifying entities under the federal designation as being a 340B covered entity. Hospitals are dependent on this 340B program to help us fund our uncompensated services out in the community. And I just want to note for the committee, this is not a small change. There are approximately 750,000 people that are in the PMAP portion of our Medicaid program. And we would urge you all to think very cautiously about disrupting this 340B program because it is so important to the hospitals. I know that this is not directly mentioned in the bill. It's due to a federal trigger in the federal rules that were passed in 2016 that when these programs are managed under fee-for-service, then it reduces the 340B discount and the 340B savings for our safety net providers. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Dr. Riggs. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Sheila Riggs, and I'm the chair of the Department of Primary Dental Care at the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry. I also chair the Dental Services Advisory Council, which is advisory to the Department of Human Services. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Minnesota Dental Homes Collaborative, a collection of critical access dental providers who have met weekly for over 15 months in an effort to identify opportunities where nonprofit dental clinics, private practice dentists, and educators in the field of dentistry could collaborate on public policy initiatives that sought to expand access to dental care and address disparities in our current delivery system. The Minnesota Dental Homes Collaborative would first like to thank Governor Walz and Commissioner Harpstead for the significant investment in the oral health of low-income Minnesotans contained in the governor's budget. A sizable influx of new dollars into the program is necessary if we hope to address the very real and growing problem low-income Minnesotans face when attempting to access dental services. However, the Minnesota Dental Homes Collaborative has significant concerns with the portion of the governor's proposal that would eliminate the critical access dental, rural access, and children's rate enhancements, in favor of an across-the-board fee-for-service rate increase. Safety net providers across the state rely on these rates to keep their doors open. More importantly, public program enrollees generally rely on us CAD providers, as fewer than 300 of the 4,000 dentists in the state account for over two-thirds of the Medicaid-enrolled dental workforce. Over the years, we CAD providers have developed clinical models that revolve around the unique needs of the medical assistant population, whether it's serving low-income children in schools and Head Start facilities, treating individuals with disabilities and older Minnesotans in their places of residence, or staffing dental clinics with bilingual healthcare professionals to serve immigrant and refugee populations. Critical access providers have stepped up to fill an important role in the dental community and are uniquely suited to provide high quality care to the patients that we see. The governor's proposal relies on the historical medical assistant fee for service rate, last set in the last century, in the late 1980s, which does not accurately reflect what critical access providers are currently being paid by the third party payers, and therefore creates a very real possibility that these essential safety net providers could see a reduction in the reimbursement rate as a result of this proposal.
All right, Dr. Riggs, I have to ask you to wrap it up.
You bet. So we just want to note that we're working closely with DHS and Representative Ryer.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Kate Tanjum.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Kate Tanjum, and I am the Chief Operating Officer at Southern Heights Dental Group. And today I am here on behalf of Southern Heights Dental Group just to give testimony on a portion of the governor's budget that is very concerning. Governor Walz's budget includes a pharmacy and dental carve-out that eliminates the critical access dental provider rate enhancement. Eliminating critical access without a proven program that in essence would hold harmless the current safety net providers would jeopardize access to care for the many thousands of low-income Minnesotans, many whom represent the BIPOC community that rely on critical access designated and safety net providers for their care. The critical access providers, Southern Heights, provides, we have proven care and the CAD providers are proven care providers for this vulnerable population. We have proven experience, expertise in navigating through the language barriers, transportation barriers, and medically complex care needs of this population. This carve-out would destabilize the foundation that we as a safety net provider have built to serve the community. And so it's just really critical that we're able to continue to serve the population that we do. Southern Heights has been around for 42 years. We were fortunate and blessed enough to become critical access providers in 2016. Prior to that, we did serve the Medicaid population, but we've been really able to expand our reach. And I think what makes us unique is we're a private practice office. So we are fee for service. We see commercial patients, and that really helps us cost shift to be able to expand our reach to meet the needs of our community and the rural healthcare shortage communities around us and provide them a dental home. We have the expertise to serve well. Our goal is to treat the patient when they're in and send them out the door better than we found them, with a place to come back to. And a lot of times that isn't what the broad sense of dental offices would be able to do, because we're equipped to meet their needs. Again, we've hired Latino translators and Somalian translators, and we work with care coordination to make sure that they are back in to receive their care. We have dental therapists. We have 32 operatories and multiple providers under one roof that we're able to really take care of the patient versus having to refer them out Obviously, we refer when we have to, but it's limited because we have a vast amount of providers with different levels of expertise. And so,
Tom, I have to ask you to wrap it up, please.
Okay. So thank you for the opportunity and for listening to our plea.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
You're welcome.
And we have Ariana Rails.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you. My name is Ariana Riles, and I am the Assistant Director of Children's Dental Services, which is a 102-year-old safety net provider serving over 35,000 low-income children, pregnant women, and families annually across 54 Minnesota counties, over 70% of whom are immigrants, refugees, or people of color. We are concerned with the dental rate reform proposal in the governor's budget, which would eliminate the Critical Access Dental Provider Program, or CAD. Without CAD, we would be forced to eliminate dental care to over 10,000 of Minnesota's most vulnerable children and families annually. We are also concerned about the single administrator proposal. Currently, the health plans in Minnesota pay us higher rates than the Department of Human Services for medical assistance for dental services and provide an array of supports, including hundreds of thousands of grant dollars and dental supplies each year. We therefore oppose the dental rate reform proposal contained within the governor's budget. Thank you so much for your consideration.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, members, we have 4 minutes left in this hearing. Representative Hewitt, you had your hand up some time ago and held off on your question. Do you want to go back to your question now?
Madam Chair, I just, MTM, I was part of that before when they were in town before, and I a number of concerns with that naturally, but I know you've committed to visiting with me on it, and I just think we have to be very careful when we proceed forward. And but the, you know, there's a lot of questions here too, as we heard over and over today in the committee, of the costs that are going to increase with this service if we keep it where it's at too. Each of the vendors told us very clearly that they're doing this at a loss. And I mean, it's definitely a service that's needed. We had major throughput flow problems in our core hospitals here in the metro area when MTM was here before, and we need to make sure that does not happen again. As you heard, what we ended up doing back then, and I think it happens now too, is we used ambulances to move these people home, and we all know that we want our ambulances for other things other than to move people that are in a wheelchair home. So we need to be very careful when we proceed with this, and I know that some of you were here before, so it's going to be interesting how we go forward. Thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me voice my opinion.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. And members, as I did say before, there's a lot to debate here, but we're really just hearing the bill to hear and understand what it has in it. This is not something that we've decided to move forward. This is the governor's budget, so we're not really here to debate. But if we have a question for the testifiers, Representative Keel, and I know that Mr. Finseth didn't get to speak. So if he's here, maybe Representative Keel, is that why you're going to mention him?
Partly, but he had trouble. So we've asked him to send his testimony to us in written form. We'll get that for you.
Thank you.
And then, Madam Chair, the other request I would have is that maybe Representative Hewitt, you'd be willing to work with me on this issue on the side and then discuss it with these groups so we can see if there's some way we can help but work within the bill coming forward.
Representative Keel, I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Hewitt.
Yeah, Representative Keel, I would welcome that, and I think we could do some good bipartisan work here. Thank you.
All right. And I just have a quick question for Dr. Riggs. Is there hope that there's going to be some kind of proposal coming forward yet this session for us, Dr. Riggs?
Thank you for the question, Madam Chair. And yes, we are working with the Minnesota Dental Association in addition to the larger group to come forward, and including we are in discussions with the DHS on this also.
All right, thank you. Well, thank you very much to all the testifiers today, and I'm glad you came to tell us about your concerns. And so we're going to continue with this bill in the hearing tomorrow, although we're going to hear different parts of the bill. And so with that, we're going to lay this bill over. We're going to take it up again tomorrow and continue on. And I do think I'm hoping we'll have the amendment language from the Department of Health as well, which we didn't have yet today. So with that, members, thank you very much. Thank you to all of the testifiers. Thanks to all the staff that are on the call, and we are adjourned.